This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I heard my husband planning my murder through our baby monitor, so I vanished without a trace, leaving them with no idea their perfect victim had become their worst nightmare. Turns out, the best way to survive your own funeral is to not show up for it. I heard my husband Mason and his brother Samuel planning my accident through our baby monitor. They thought I was asleep upstairs, but I was in the nursery. By morning, Jessica Williams had vanished without a trace, and they had no idea. Their perfect victim had become their worst nightmare. 3 days. That's how long it's been since I disappeared from my own life. Since I heard the two men I trusted most in this world, calmly discussing the best way to kill me. 3 days since I learned that my loving husband of 8 years and his devoted brother had been planning my death with the same casual tone they'd used to discuss weekend fishing plans. I'm sitting in a rental car outside a coffee shop in Portland, Oregon, 400 miles from the life I knew in Sacramento, watching the rain streak down my windshield as I plan my next move. But before I tell you how I'm going to destroy them, let me take you back to that moment when everything shattered. The moment when Jessica Williams, the trusting wife and successful real estate developer, died, and someone much more dangerous was born. It started like any other Tuesday evening. Mason, my husband, had invited his brother Samuel over for dinner, something that happened at least twice a week. Samuel, recently divorced and struggling with his construction business, had been leaning on us heavily for both emotional and financial support. I'd been nothing but welcoming, even lending him $50,000 to keep his company afloat when the banks turned him down. I was supposed to be at my evening yoga class, had been going religiously every Tuesday for 3 years. But that night, I'd felt exhausted. The stress of managing my latest development project, a luxury condominium complex worth $12 million, had been weighing on me. So I texted my instructor, claiming a headache, and decided to surprise Mason with his favorite home-cooked meal instead. The irony isn't lost on me now. My decision to skip yoga that one time, a decision meant to show love and care, ended up saving my life. I'd parked in the driveway quietly, not wanting to ruin the surprise. Our house, a beautiful craftsman-style home in one of Sacramento's most prestigious neighborhoods, had always felt like a sanctuary. Now, it feels like a crime scene. I'd entered through the back door, planning to start cooking immediately when I heard voices from the living room. Nothing unusual there. Mason and Samuel often discussed business, sports, their shared frustration with Samuel's ex-wife Valerie's demands for higher alimony payments. I was actually pleased they were bonding. Samuel had been in a dark place since his divorce finalized 6 months ago. But something in their tone made me pause. There was an intensity, a seriousness that felt different. I found myself lingering in the kitchen, straining to hear when Samuel's words hit me like a physical blow. "The insurance policy is solid," he was saying, his voice low but clear. $2 million. And she just increased it last month for the new business venture. My blood turned to ice. They were talking about my life insurance policy, the one I'd updated when I'd taken on the condo project, the one Mason had encouraged me to increase, saying it was smart business practice for someone managing such large investments. "The construction site is perfect," Mason's voice replied. And I had to grip the kitchen counter to stay upright. Accident-prone areas everywhere, a scaffolding collapse, maybe a crane malfunction. "Samuel, you know those sites better than anyone." Samuel, my brother-in-law, whom I trusted, whom I'd helped financially, whom I'd welcomed into our home like family. He was planning to kill me at one of his construction sites. "When?" Samuel asked. And the casual nature of the question made my stomach lurch soon. "The condo project closes escrow next month. Once that's finalized and the money hits our accounts, we move. Jessica's been so stressed about the project lately, working late, visiting the sites constantly. No one would question her being there after hours. I realized with growing horror that they'd been watching me, studying my patterns, noting my habits. Every late evening I'd spent at the construction site, every time I'd mentioned feeling overwhelmed by the project's demands, they'd been cataloging it all, building their narrative. What about afterward? Samuel continued. The investigation, the questions? Mason's laugh was cold, unfamiliar. Two grieving brothers devastated by the loss of a beloved wife and sister-in-law. You'll inherit the construction company expansion. Loan. We'll take out in Jessica's name next week. I'll inherit everything else. We'll sell this house, the business, everything. Split it down the middle like we always planned, like they always planned. The words echoed in my mind. How long had they been planning this? Months? Years? She trusts us both completely, Samuel added, and I could hear the smile in his voice. Never suspects a thing. Still thinks I'm the struggling grateful brother-in-law who needs her help. The baby monitor. I suddenly realized why I could hear them so clearly. We bought it 6 months ago when we'd started trying for children. Installing the receiver in the kitchen so I could hear if there were any issues while I was cooking. The base unit was in the living room where they were sitting, planning my murder. Technology meant to protect future children was instead revealing a plot to ensure I'd never have them. I stood frozen in my own kitchen, listening to the two most important men in my life dissect my value like a business transaction. Mason mentioned my recent doctor's appointments. I'd been having some minor health issues, stress-related, my physician had said. Nothing serious, but they'd been planning to use even that against me, perhaps claiming I'd been disoriented or careless. Every gesture of love, every moment of trust, every financial decision I'd made to help Samuel, it had all been manipulation. They'd been grooming me for murder. But as I listened to their detailed planning, something unexpected happened. The shock began to crystallize into something harder, colder. I'm a successful businesswoman. Someone who's built a multi-million dollar real estate empire from nothing. I didn't get here by being passive or helpless. And I certainly didn't survive the cutthroat world of property development by letting people take advantage of me. If Mason and Samuel thought they were hunting a helpless victim, they were about to learn how wrong they were. I slipped out of the house the same way I'd entered, my mind already racing with possibilities. They wanted Jessica Williams dead. Fine. She could disappear. But what they'd created in her place would be something much more dangerous. By dawn, I was gone, leaving behind only questions and a mystery that would soon become their worst nightmare. Because sometimes the best way to win a game is to stop playing by the rules your opponents expect. The first 24 hours after my disappearance were the most critical. While Mason and Samuel were probably just realizing something was wrong, I was already three moves ahead, systematically dismantling the life that Jessica Williams had built while creating something entirely new. I'd driven through the night, my hands steady on the wheel despite the adrenaline coursing through my veins. The rental car, paid for with cash from an emergency fund Mason didn't know existed, carried me north on Interstate 5, while my phone, deliberately left behind on my nightstand, would show my last location as our bedroom. Let them wonder if I'd been taken, if I'd run, or if something worse had happened. The beauty of being a real estate developer is that you understand the value of preparation and contingency planning. 3 years ago, when I'd first started working on major projects, I'd opened a separate business account under my maiden name, Jessica Chen. Nothing illegal, just a precaution in case I ever needed to handle transactions without Mason's involvement. The account had grown quietly, fed by small percentages from each successful project. Now, that forgotten account contained nearly $200,000. Money that didn't exist in Mason's world, money that would fund my new life and, eventually, their destruction. By Tuesday morning I was checking into a modest hotel in Portland under my maiden name, paying cash for a week's stay. The desk clerk, a tired-looking woman named Nikita, barely glanced at my identification. To her, I was just another business traveler. She had no idea she was helping a dead woman disappear. I spent the first day in that hotel room, methodically, planning. Mason would wake up expecting to find me gone for my morning run, a routine I'd maintained for 5 years. When I didn't return by 9 a.m., he'd start calling. By noon, he'd be genuinely worried. By evening, he'd involve the police. But here's what Mason didn't know about his devoted wife. I'd been documenting everything for years. Not because I suspected him. My trust had been complete and devastating. But because successful business requires meticulous records, every financial transaction, every business decision, every loan I'd made to, Samuel was documented, backed up, and stored in multiple locations, including the $50,000 I'd lent Samuel. The loan he thought was a casual family favor was actually a formal business transaction complete with contracts, payment schedules, and penalty clauses. I'd insisted on the paperwork, telling him it was just good business practice. He'd signed everything, probably thinking his sister-in-law was being unnecessarily formal. That contract would become very important soon. From my hotel room, I began making calls, not to Mason. He thought I was missing, possibly kidnapped, or worse. Instead, I called Gerald Martinez, my business attorney, and one of the few people who knew about my separate accounts and backup documentation systems. Jessica? His voice was surprised when he answered. I thought you were missing. Mason called this morning, said the police were looking for you. I need to see you, I said simply. Today. And Gerald? This conversation never happened. Gerald had been my lawyer for 6 years, had helped me navigate complex real estate deals worth tens of millions of dollars. He was also a man who understood that sometimes business gets complicated, and that the best lawyers are the
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Ones who ask the right questions rather than too many questions. We met at his office at 6 p.m. after his regular staff had gone home. I'd driven back to Sacramento, carefully avoiding the neighborhoods where Mason or Samuel might see me. The risk was calculated. I needed Gerald's help, and some things required face-to-face conversation. They think you're dead, Gerald said bluntly as I sat across from his mahogany desk. Mason's beside himself. Samuel's been helping coordinate search efforts. I'm sure they are, I thought. Nothing like a grieving husband and brother-in-law to deflect suspicion. I need you to help me access some accounts, I told him. And I need to understand exactly what my disappearance means legally. Gerald leaned back in his chair, studying me with the sharp eyes that had made him one of Sacramento's most successful attorneys. Jessica, if you're alive and deliberately hiding, there are implications. Insurance fraud, if someone tries to claim you're dead. Abandonment issues, if Mason tries to claim desertion. What if I had evidence that my life was in danger, that my disappearance was necessary for my safety? His expression shifted. That changes everything. Self-preservation isn't abandonment. And if you can prove threat or conspiracy, he paused. What kind of evidence are we talking about? I pulled out a small digital recorder, one I'd purchased that morning with cash, the kind that puts people in prison. For the next 2 hours, I played Gerald selected portions of what I'd recorded through the baby monitor. I'd been smart enough to use my phone to record their conversation, creating a digital backup before I'd fled. His face grew increasingly grim as he listened to Mason and Samuel casually discussing my murder. This is conspiracy to commit murder, he said quietly. Jessica, you need to go to the police immediately. No. My voice was firm. The police will arrest them, they'll get lawyers, and maybe they'll plea bargain their way to reduce sentences. Maybe the evidence gets challenged. Maybe they claim it was just dark humor or fantasy. Then what do you want? I looked out Gerald's office window at the Sacramento skyline, the city where I'd built my business empire, where I'd thought I'd found love and family. I want them to destroy themselves. I want them to reveal exactly who they are in a way that leaves no room for doubt or legal maneuvering. That's dangerous, Jessica. If they realize you're alive and know about their plan, then they'll have to decide whether to run or double down. Either way, they lose. Gerald was quiet for a long moment. Finally, he spoke. What do you need? From me? Patience, legal cover, and help accessing funds they don't know exist. As I left his office that night, I felt the last pieces of my old life falling away. Jessica Williams, the trusting wife, was truly dead now. What remained was someone harder, smarter, and infinitely more dangerous. Mason and Samuel wanted to kill me for money. Instead, I was going to let them destroy themselves trying. What Mason and Samuel didn't understand about me, what perhaps no one truly understood, was that my success in real estate hadn't come from luck or charm. It had come from an almost obsessive ability to research, analyze, and anticipate every possible scenario before making a move. In business, this had made me millions. Now it would make me untouchable. Returning to my Portland hotel that night, I spread everything across the small desk. financial records, contracts, phone logs, and my laptop loaded with 8 years of meticulously organized digital files. Most wives might know their husband's favorite coffee order or his mother's birthday. I knew Mason's social security number, his credit score, every bank account, every investment, and every debt he'd accumulated. Since we'd been together, the picture that emerged as I worked through the night was devastating. Mason wasn't just planning to kill me for insurance money. He was drowning financially, and had been for over a year. Those successful cases he'd been celebrating at his law firm, most had been settled for far less than he'd claimed. The two expensive dinners, the new car, the designer suits, all of it had been financed through credit cards and loans I knew nothing about. But the real revelation came when I accessed our joint business accounts, the ones tied to my real estate developments. Over the past 6 months, Mason had been making small withdrawals, each just under the threshold that would trigger automatic notifications to me. $5,000 here, $8,000 there. Individually, they looked like legitimate business expenses. Together, they totaled nearly $90,000. My devoted husband had been embezzling from me for months. Samuel's financial situation was even worse than I'd imagined. The construction business I'd helped him save was a shell company now, kept alive only by the money he'd borrowed from us and a web of contractor debts he had no intention of paying. His divorce from Valerie hadn't just cost him alimony. She'd taken half of everything, including assets he'd apparently been hiding from me and Mason. But here's where my real estate expertise became a weapon. I understood how to trace property, ownership, business registrations, and financial partnerships, and what I discovered made their murder plot even more sinister. 6 weeks ago, Samuel had quietly registered a new LLC, Sam Mass Construction Solutions. The name was a combination of their names, and Mason was listed as a silent partner with a 30% stake. They'd been planning to use my insurance money to launch a legitimate business together, built on my corpse. The scope of their betrayal was breathtaking. This wasn't a desperate plan conceived in a moment of financial panic. This was a calculated, long-term strategy that had been developing for months, possibly years. My phone, a new burner I'd purchased with cash, buzzed with a news alert. The local Sacramento stations were running the story. Prominent real estate developer missing, police investigating. The accompanying photo showed Mason at a press conference, his face perfectly composed in grief and concern. Samuel stood beside him, the supportive brother-in-law helping coordinate search efforts. They were good. I had to give them that. Mason's performance was flawless. The worried husband desperate for any news about his beloved wife. The media ate it up. Comments on the news websites showed an outpouring of sympathy for the devoted husband dealing with this tragedy. But I had advantages they couldn't anticipate. My success in real estate had required building relationships with people across every industry: contractors, inspectors, city planners, private investigators, security specialists. Over the years, I'd helped many of them with property deals, zoning issues, and investment opportunities. Now those relationships would serve a different purpose. Andy Richardson had been Sacramento's most sought-after private investigator before he'd retired 2 years ago. I'd helped him find the perfect property for his security consulting business, and he'd saved me hundreds of thousands on a development deal by uncovering hidden environmental issues before I'd committed to purchase. I called him at midnight. "Jessica. Chen," he said, using my maiden name immediately. He was the kind of man who understood that when someone called at midnight using a different name than usual, there were reasons. "I heard about your situation. I need help, Andy. The kind of help that stays completely confidential." "What kind of help?" "The kind that involves watching people who think they're very clever." We met the next morning at a diner in a small town outside Sacramento. Andy was exactly as I remembered, mid-50s, gray hair, eyes that noticed everything and revealed nothing. He listened without interruption as I explained the situation, playing him portions of the recorded conversation. "You want surveillance on your husband and his brother," he said when I finished. "I want to know everything. Where they go, who they talk to, what they're planning. I want their phones monitored, their communications tracked, their movements documented. That's extensive and expensive." I slid an envelope across the table. "There's $20,000 in cash. Consider it a retainer." Andy opened the envelope, counted quickly, then looked at me with new respect. "You've been planning this." "I've been planning contingencies my entire adult life. I just never thought I'd need the one for surviving my own murder." "There's something else you should know," Andy said. "Your husband hired a private investigator yesterday. Someone to help find you." My blood chilled. "Who?" Danica Torres. She's good, but she's also expensive. Your husband is paying her $10,000 upfront to coordinate with the police search. $10,000. Money Mason didn't have unless he'd taken more from our accounts. But more importantly, he was being proactive about finding me in a way that seemed excessive for someone who supposedly had no idea where I was. Can you find out what he's told her? I asked. I can do better than that. Danica and I worked together for 15 years before I retired. She trusts me. And she's very interested in cases where the grieving spouse might not be as innocent as they appear. As I drove back to Portland that afternoon, I felt the balance of power shifting. Mason and Samuel thought they were hunting a victim who had inconveniently disappeared. They had no idea they were now being hunted by someone who understood exactly how dangerous they were. The next phase of my plan was simple. Let them reveal themselves while I gathered enough evidence to destroy them completely. In real estate, the key to any successful development is a solid foundation. I was about to build the foundation for their complete destruction. Andy's first surveillance report arrived 48 hours later, delivered to a secure email account I'd established using an encrypted service. What I read made me realize that Mason and Samuel's conspiracy was far more sophisticated and far more dangerous than I'd initially understood. They weren't just planning my murder. They'd been systematically positioning themselves for months, creating alibis, establishing patterns, and manipulating circumstances with the precision of professional criminals. According to Andy's surveillance, Mason had visited Samuel's construction site 3 times in the past week, always after hours, always when no other workers were present. The site foreman, a man named Carlos who'd worked with Samuel for over 2 years, had been mysteriously laid off the day before my disappearance. His replacement was someone Samuel had hired personally, someone with no connection to me or knowledge of my usual visits to construction sites. But the most chilling detail was what Andy had discovered about my life insurance policy. Your husband didn't just encourage you to increase your coverage, Andy's report stated. He specifically researched accidental death benefits, and had multiple conversations with the insurance agent about scenarios that would trigger double indemnity clauses. The agent remembers him being particularly interested in workplace accidents and the timeline for investigations. Double indemnity. If my death appeared accidental, Mason wouldn't just inherit $2 million, he'd receive $4 million. And workplace accidents, especially in construction, were notoriously difficult to investigate thoroughly. I was sitting in a small cafe in Portland, reading this information on my laptop, when my new phone rang. The number was local Sacramento, someone I didn't recognize. Is this Jessica Chen? The voice was female, professional, unfamiliar. My heart stopped. Only a handful of people knew I was using my maiden name, and most of them had no reason to call me. Who is this? Danica Torres. I'm a private investigator working on your case. Your husband hired me to help find you. I almost hung up immediately, but something in her tone made me pause. There was an edge to her voice, a carefully controlled tension that suggested this wasn't a routine call. What do you want? I want to meet alone. There are things about this case that aren't adding up, and I think you might have answers. It was a trap. It had to be. Mason had somehow discovered I was alive, and had sent his hired investigator to flush me out. But as I sat there, considering my options, I realized something important. If Danica Torres was calling me, it meant she'd found me through methods that had nothing to do with Mason's help. How did you get this number? Bank records from your maiden name account, hotel registration in Portland, security camera footage from the coffee shop where you met with Andy Richardson. Her voice was matter-of-fact. You're good at disappearing, but you're not invisible. Not to someone who knows how to look. Andy. She'd followed Andy, which meant she was better than he'd anticipated. But it also meant she was working independently, not just following Mason's directions. What makes you think this case doesn't add up? I asked tearfully. Your husband's financial records, his behavior during interviews, the timeline of events leading up to your disappearance. She paused. And the fact that someone matching your description used a credit card under your maiden name to rent a car in Sacramento 2 hours before you were officially reported missing. She was good, dangerously good, which meant I had a choice. Treat her as an enemy, and try to evade her, or find out if she might be an ally. Where do you want to meet? Powell's Books, downtown Portland. 1 hour. Come alone. And come prepared to explain why your loving husband has been lying to me since the moment he hired me. I spent the drive to Powell's analyzing every possible scenario. If this was a trap, I was walking into it with my eyes open. If it wasn't, I might be about to gain a powerful ally with skills I desperately needed. Danica Torres was waiting in the rare book section, a woman in her 40s with sharp eyes and an immediately recognizable intelligence. She was studying a book on financial crimes when I approached, and she looked up with an expression that suggested she'd been expecting me. "You look exactly like your photos," she said quietly, "except for the part where you're supposed to be missing, and possibly dead. What do you want?" She closed the book and turned to face me directly. "I want to know why your husband hired me to find you when he already knows you're alive." The statement hit me like a physical blow. "What? Your husband isn't a grieving spouse desperately searching for his missing wife. He's a man managing a situation. Every question I've asked him has been answered too quickly, too smoothly. Every emotion has been perfectly calibrated for the audience." She paused. "I've been doing this for 20 years. I know the difference between genuine grief and performance. That doesn't mean he knows I'm alive. No. But the phone call he made 30 minutes after he hired me does." Danica pulled out a small digital recorder. "He called someone, his brother, based on the conversation, and told him that hiring me was perfect cover, and that having a professional investigator find nothing would close the case permanently." My mind raced. Mason hadn't hired Danica to find me. He'd hired her to fail to find me, creating official documentation that I'd simply vanished without a trace. "They're planning to wait," Danica continued. "Let the investigation go cold. Let the media attention die down. Then, in a few months, they'll have me declare the case unsolvable and recommend that you be declared legally dead." "Why are you telling me this?" Danica smiled grimly. "Because I don't like being used. And because I've spent the last 3 days researching your husband and his brother. What I've found suggests they're planning something that goes way beyond insurance fraud." She handed me a manila folder. "Samuel's Construction Company has been bidding on city contracts using falsified safety records and non-existent insurance policies. Your husband has been helping him navigate the legal requirements, and they've been using your real estate connections to secure projects." I opened the folder and found photocopies of contracts, bidding documents, and safety inspections. All fraudulent, all carrying my business license numbers as a reference for credibility. They've been using my reputation to commit fraud for over a year. And if any of their projects fail, if anyone gets hurt, if any investigations happen, all the liability traces back to you. Your business license, your insurance, your professional reputation. The scope of their betrayal kept expanding. They weren't just planning to kill me for insurance money. They'd been destroying my professional life, ensuring that even if I somehow survived their murder attempt, I'd be financially and legally ruined. But as I sat there, absorbing the full magnitude of their conspiracy, I felt something unexpected, relief, because now I knew exactly how to destroy them. Danica and I spent the next 3 hours in a corner booth at a quiet restaurant, spreading documents across the table like generals planning a war. What she'd uncovered in just 72 hours of investigation was staggering. A web of corruption that extended far beyond Mason and Samuel's plan to murder me. "Your husband's law firm doesn't know about any of this," Danica explained, pointing to a series of contracts. "He's been using his position and legal credentials to facilitate Samuel's fraudulent bids, but he's kept it completely separate from his official practice. If this comes to light, the firm will throw him under the bus to protect themselves." The contracts were damning. Samuel had been winning city construction projects by submitting bids that were impossibly low, then cutting costs by using substandard materials and falsifying safety inspections. The profit margins should have made the fraud obvious. But Mason had been providing legal cover, creating shell companies and dummy insurance policies that made everything appear legitimate on paper. "How much money are we talking about?" I asked. "Over the past 18 months? Nearly $3 million in fraudulent contracts. But here's the part that should terrify you. Two of those projects are schools." My blood ran cold. They weren't just stealing money. They were putting children's lives at risk with substandard construction. The elementary school renovation in South Sacramento, the new gymnasium at Lincoln High School, both projects carried Samuel's signature and my business license as a credibility reference. "There's more," Danica continued, pulling out another set of documents. "I found correspondence between your husband and a man named Victor Castellanos. He's Samuel's contact at the city planning office. The one who's been fast-tracking the bid approvals, Victor Castellanos. I knew that name. He'd approached me 6 months ago about a potential development deal. Something that had seemed too good to be true. I'd declined, but not before he'd expressed particular interest in my business practices and professional connections." "They were recruiting you," Danica said, reading my expression. Victor needed someone with legitimate credentials and a spotless reputation to provide cover for larger scale fraud. When you wouldn't cooperate willingly, they decided to use me anyway, and then eliminate me when the scheme was complete. The pieces were falling into place with sickening clarity. Danica nodded grimly. Your death would accomplish multiple goals. Insurance money, elimination of the primary witness who could expose their fraud, and a tragic story that would deflect any investigation into Samuel's business practices. Who's going to aggressively investigate a grieving widow's construction company after she dies in a workplace accident? I stared at the documents, feeling the true scope of their betrayal wash over me. This wasn't just about killing me for money. They'd been systematically destroying everything I'd built while positioning themselves to profit from the wreckage. Victor's getting nervous, Danica continued. I've been monitoring communications, and there's been increased pressure from city auditors. Someone filed a complaint about irregularities in the bidding process. Who filed the complaint? Anonymous tip. But based on the specific details mentioned, it came from someone with inside knowledge of construction practices and city regulations. A possibility occurred to me. Valerie, Samuel's ex-wife, what makes you think that? She worked as a project manager for the city planning department before their divorce. She'd know exactly what to look for, and she'd have access to the right people to file an effective complaint. I paused, thinking. Samuel mentioned during their conversation that she was demanding higher alimony payments. What if she discovered his fraud, and is using it as leverage? Danica pulled out her phone and scrolled through her notes. That would explain the timeline pressure. If Valerie is threatening to expose them unless Samuel pays more support, they need to complete their plan quickly before she can destroy them. I felt a cold smile spreading across my face, which means they're about to make mistakes. You're thinking of contacting her. I'm thinking of giving her the tools to finish what she started. Danica leaned back in her chair, studying me with new respect. You're not just trying to survive. This are you. You're planning to take them all down. They turned my life's work into a criminal enterprise. They put children at risk. They plan to murder me, and profit from it. I gathered the documents into a neat stack. Survival isn't enough anymore. What do you need from me? Everything you can find on Victor Castellanos. Every communication between him and Mason. Every project they've corrupted using my credentials. I paused. And I need you to keep working for Mason, at least for now. You want me to be a double agent? I want you to feed him information that makes him feel safe while gathering evidence that will destroy him. Can you do that? Danica smiled, and for the first time, it reached her eyes. Lady, I've been waiting my entire career for a case like this. Mason thinks he hired me to cover up his crimes. Instead, he's paying me to document them. As we left the restaurant, I felt the final pieces of my strategy crystallizing. Mason and Samuel had built their conspiracy on a foundation of lies, fraud, and betrayal. Now I was going to use that same foundation to bring their entire world crashing down. They wanted Jessica Williams dead? Fine. But they were about to discover that what rose from her ashes was something far more dangerous than they'd ever imagined. That night, alone in my Portland hotel room, I found myself staring at my wedding photo. The only personal item I'd taken when I fled. Mason's smile looked so genuine. His arm around my waist so protective. I remembered that day 8 years ago with perfect clarity. How certain I'd been that I'd found my person, my partner for life. The signs had been there from the beginning. I just hadn't recognized them as warnings. We'd met at a real estate law seminar in San Francisco. I was 26, 3 years into building my development business, hungry for success and knowledge. Mason was the keynote speaker, 32 years old, and already a partner at his firm, brilliant and confident in a way that drew everyone's attention. He'd approached me during the cocktail reception, complimenting my questions during his presentation about zoning law complexities. "You're Jessica Chen," he'd said, as if my name carried weight. "I've been following your work on the Riverside Commons project, impressive for someone so young." The fact that he knew my work, that he'd researched me before we'd even met, at the time, I'd found it flattering. Now I understood it as his first move in an 8-year game of manipulation. Our courtship had been perfect. Too perfect. Mason had been attentive without being clingy, successful without being arrogant, supportive of my career while maintaining his own ambitions. He'd integrated himself into my life so smoothly that within 6 months, I couldn't imagine making any major decision without his input. When I'd started working on larger projects, Mason had insisted on reviewing all my contracts. "I want to protect you," he'd said. "This business is full of people who'll take advantage of someone who trusts too easily. The irony was suffocating now. Our wedding had been everything I'd dreamed of, elegant, intimate, surrounded by people who loved us. Samuel had been Mason's best man, giving a toast about how lucky Mason was to find someone who balanced his intensity with warmth and generosity. He'd actually gotten emotional talking about how I'd welcomed him into our family, how grateful he was to have a sister-in-law who treated him like a real brother. Every word had been a lie, delivered with tears in his eyes and a champagne glass, raised in my honor. The first crack in the facade had come 2 years into our marriage, though I'd dismissed it at the time. I discovered that Mason had been checking my business emails, claiming he was just trying to help manage my workload when I was overwhelmed with a difficult project. When I'd asked him to stop, he'd apologized profusely, explaining that his protective instincts sometimes got the better of him. "I just worry about you," he'd said, holding me close. "You trust people too much. Not everyone has your best interests at heart." Another red flag I'd painted green with love and rationalization. Samuel's divorce had brought him closer to us, or so I'd thought. Valerie had left him after discovering he'd been hiding money and lying about his business expenses. At the time, I'd sympathized with Samuel, believing his version of events, that Valerie was vindictive and unreasonable, that she was trying to destroy him out of spite. Now I wondered what Valerie had really discovered. What lies had she uncovered that had driven her away? The $50,000 loan to Samuel had been my idea, presented to Mason as a way to help his brother get back on his feet after the divorce. Mason had seemed reluctant at first, warning me that mixing family and money was dangerous. But when I'd insisted, he'd suddenly become supportive, even suggesting we could afford to lend more if needed. I'd thought I was being generous, helping family in crisis. In reality, I'd been funding the initial phase of their conspiracy. Looking back, I could trace the escalation. 6 months after the loan, Mason had started suggesting I increase my insurance coverage. "With the bigger projects you're taking on, we need to protect ourselves," he'd explained. Then came his encouragement to work more closely with Samuel's construction company on my developments, creating a professional relationship that would justify my presence at his work sites. Every suggestion had made perfect sense at the time. Every decision had seemed natural, collaborative, smart. But viewed through the lens of their recorded conversation, I could see the careful orchestration behind every moment. The most painful realization was understanding how they'd weaponized my strengths against me. My generosity had funded their scheme. My trust had blinded me to their deception. My professional success had provided the credibility they needed for their fraud. My love for family had made me the perfect victim. But as I sat there in that anonymous hotel room surrounded by evidence of their betrayal, I felt something unexpected alongside the pain. Gratitude. Because their mistake hadn't been underestimating my intelligence or my resources. Their mistake had been teaching me through 8 years of careful manipulation exactly how they operated. They'd shown me their methods, their patience, their attention to detail. Now I was going to use everything they'd taught me against them. Mason had molded me into the perfect victim, but in doing so, he'd also created the perfect predator. Someone who understood him completely, who knew his weaknesses as intimately as he'd believed he knew mine. The woman in the wedding photo was gone. What remained was someone harder, smarter, and infinitely more dangerous. Someone who'd learned from the masters of manipulation, and was about to demonstrate just how well she'd absorbed their lessons. My transformation from victim to hunter required more than just emotional resolve. It demanded a systematic approach to gathering evidence that would stand up in court and destroy their lives completely. Over the next week, I established what I privately called my war room, in a furnished apartment I'd rented under my maiden name in downtown Portland. The apartment's dining room table became command central, covered with printed emails, financial records, photographs, and a detailed timeline stretching back 3 years. I divided their conspiracy into categories: financial fraud, insurance manipulation, safety violations, and murder conspiracy. Each category had its own color-coded system, cross-referenced and documented with the precision that had made me successful in real estate development. Danica proved invaluable during this phase. Her daily reports from Sacramento painted a picture of Mason and Samuel growing increasingly confident in their success, while simultaneously making crucial mistakes. "Mason's been visiting Samuel's office every day since you disappeared," she reported during one of our encrypted video calls. "They're not even trying to hide their meetings anymore. Yesterday, I followed Mason to a storage unit facility. He spent an hour inside Unit 247, which is registered under Samuel's business name, a storage unit. People only rented storage units for things they needed to hide, but couldn't throw away. Can you get in?" "Already working on it. The facility has minimal security, and I have contacts who specialize in locks. While Danica handled surveillance, I focused on the digital evidence. Mason had always been meticulous about his electronic communications, but he'd made one critical error. He'd never changed the passwords to our shared accounts after my disappearance. Why would he? I was supposed to be dead. Through our joint credit card statements, I could track every suspicious purchase from the past 6 months, a payment to a mechanic shop that specialized in brake systems the same week before my accident was supposed to happen, cash withdrawals that coincided with Samuel's meetings with Victor Castellanos, payments to a company called Mountain Safety Solutions that, when I researched it, turned out to be a front for purchasing untraceable equipment. But the most damning evidence came from an unexpected source, Mason's law firm's internal email system. Gerald, my attorney, had maintained his own contacts within Mason's firm through years of professional interactions. When I explained what I needed, he made a carefully worded inquiry about document preservation requirements in cases involving missing persons. The firm's IT department is implementing a complete email backup as a precaution, Gerald reported. Standard procedure when a partner's spouse goes missing. They're protecting themselves against potential liability, but it also means every email Mason has sent or received in the past year is now preserved on secure servers. Can we access them? Not legally. But if those emails were to surface during a criminal investigation, Gerald's pause was meaningful. The firm would be required to turn over anything relevant. That gave me an idea. If I could provide law enforcement with enough evidence to justify a search warrant, Mason's own firm would become the source of his downfall. I spent 3 days crafting an anonymous tip package for the FBI's white-collar crime division. The package included copies of the fraudulent city contracts, evidence of the shell companies, bank records showing suspicious cash flows, and detailed documentation of safety violations at Samuel's construction sites. Most importantly, I included photographs that Danica had taken of Mason and Samuel meeting with Victor Castellanos at a restaurant outside Sacramento. The photos showed Victor accepting an envelope from Mason while Samuel reviewed what appeared to be building inspection documents, but I held back the recording of their murder conspiracy. That would be my insurance policy saved for when they thought they'd escaped consequences for their fraud. The response was swift. Within 48 hours of submitting the anonymous tip, federal agents raided Samuel's construction office and the storage unit Danica had identified. Local news reported that the FBI was investigating potential irregularities in city construction contracts. From my Portland apartment, I watched Mason's first public response to the investigation on the local news. He stood beside Samuel outside the construction office, both men presenting a united front of shock and cooperation. "My brother and his company have always operated with complete integrity," Mason told reporters. "We're confident this investigation will clear up any misunderstandings. Right now, our focus remains on finding my wife and bringing her home safely." Perfect. Mason was publicly linking himself to Samuel's business practices while maintaining his image as a grieving husband. Every word he spoke was being recorded, and every statement would become evidence of his knowledge and involvement. Danica's evening report brought even better news. The federal investigation spooked Victor Castellanos. "He's been making calls all day. And one of them was to someone at the mayor's office. I think he's trying to get ahead of this by cooperating with investigators." A cooperating witness with inside knowledge of their scheme would be devastating for Mason and Samuel, but I needed to ensure that Victor's cooperation led to the right conclusions. "Can you get close enough to Victor to influence what information he shares?" "Already on it. He's scared, which makes him predictable. Give me 48 hours. As I prepared for bed that night, I felt the momentum shifting decisively in my favor. Mason and Samuel had built their conspiracy in secret, confident that their careful planning would protect them. They were about to learn that the most dangerous enemy is the one you create yourself. The federal investigation had an immediate domino effect that neither Mason nor Samuel had anticipated. Within 72 hours of the FBI raid, their carefully constructed world began unraveling in ways that went far beyond what I'd initially set in motion. Danica's morning call brought the first major breakthrough. Victor Castellanos didn't just cooperate with the FBI. "He's singing like a canary in a coal mine. Turns out your husband and Samuel weren't his only clients." She'd managed to position herself close enough to Victor during his federal questioning to overhear critical details. The corruption scheme involved at least 6 other construction companies and reached into multiple city departments. Mason and Samuel weren't the masterminds they thought they were. They were mid-level players in a much larger conspiracy. "The feds are calling it Operation Clean Foundation," Danica continued. They're looking at construction fraud totaling over $20 million across the past 3 years. Your husband just became a person of interest in a federal racketeering investigation. But the most shocking revelation came from an unexpected source. Valerie, Samuel's ex-wife, had contacted the FBI independently. She's been documenting Samuel's illegal activities since before their divorce, Danica explained. Bank records, recorded conversations, photographs of falsified inspection documents. She's got enough evidence to put him away for 20 years. And she's been waiting for the right moment to use it. Valerie hadn't just discovered Samuel's fraud. She'd been building a case against him for over 2 years. Her divorce demands weren't just about alimony. They were about keeping Samuel distracted while she gathered evidence that would eventually destroy him. I felt a grudging respect for my former sister-in-law. While I'd been playing the trusting wife, she'd been playing a much longer, more patient game. Does she know about the murder plot? I asked. Not yet. But she wants to meet with you. The meeting was arranged for the next evening at a small wine bar in Portland's Pearl District. Valerie looked older than I remembered, stress etched in lines around her eyes, but there was a steely determination in her posture that I recognized. The look of someone who'd been pushed too far and was finally pushing back. I know you're alive, were her first words as she sat down across from me. And I know why you disappeared. She pulled out a digital recorder identical to the one I'd used to capture Mason and Samuel's conversation. I've been monitoring Samuel's phone calls since our divorce was finalized. Last Tuesday night, he called Mason in a panic about the Jessica problem, and whether they needed to accelerate the timeline. My blood ran cold. They'd been discussing my murder on monitored phone lines, too arrogant or desperate to maintain proper operational security. Why didn't you warn me? Valerie's expression hardened. Because I tried to warn you 3 years ago, and you didn't listen. When I told you Samuel was stealing from his clients, you defended him. When I mentioned that Mason was asking suspicious questions about your business practices, you said I was being paranoid because of my divorce. She was right. I remembered those conversations now, colored by my loyalty to Mason and my sympathy for Samuel. Valerie had tried to open my eyes, and I'd dismissed her concerns as the bitter accusations of an angry ex-wife. I decided the only way to stop them was to gather enough evidence to destroy them completely, she continued. Your disappearance just accelerated my timeline. Valerie spread her own collection of documents across the table, bank records, recorded phone calls, photographs, business documents. Her evidence was even more comprehensive than mine, spanning years of Samuel's criminal activities, and Mason's involvement in covering them up. They killed someone else, she said quietly. The words hit me like a physical blow. What? 2 years ago, a city inspector named Roberto Martinez, who was getting too close to their safety violations. He died in a car accident, brake failure, on a mountain road. The police ruled it accidental. She handed me a police report and insurance documents. Roberto Martinez, 43 years old, married with 2 children. He'd been investigating irregularities in Samuel's construction projects when his car went off Highway 50, killing him instantly. The brake failure was identical to what they planned for you, Valerie explained. Same mechanic shop did the work. Same type of accident. Same insurance investigator, who ruled it mechanical failure rather than sabotage. I stared at the documents feeling sick. They hadn't just been planning my murder. They'd already committed murder to protect their scheme. Roberto Martinez had died because he'd been doing his job too well. Why didn't you take this to the police? Because I needed more than suspicion. I needed absolute proof. And I needed to make sure they couldn't escape or destroy evidence when the walls closed in. Valerie's smile was cold and satisfied, which is exactly what's happening now. The federal investigation had spooked other participants in the corruption scheme. 3 more city employees had been arrested, and 2 additional construction companies were under investigation. The web was expanding exponentially, and Mason and Samuel were trapped at the center of it. There's something else, Valerie said. Samuel's been trying to contact you. What do you mean? He's been calling your old phone number, leaving voicemails, panicked messages about needing to fix things and make this right. He thinks you might be hiding rather than dead, and he's terrified you're going to surface and destroy him. Perfect. Samuel's panic was making him sloppy, leaving electronic evidence of his desperation. Every voicemail he left was another piece of evidence demonstrating his consciousness of guilt. What do you want from me? I asked. I want you to help me finish this. Together we have enough evidence to put them both away for life, but I want to make sure they pay for Roberto Martinez too. As I shook hands with Valerie, I realized that Mason and Samuel's biggest mistake hadn't been underestimating me. It had been creating too many enemies. They'd built their conspiracy on a foundation of betrayal and murder, and now every person they'd wronged was closing in on them. The hunters had become the hunted, and they didn't even realize it yet. The alliance between Valerie, Danica, and myself transformed from a collection of individual revenge plots into something far more powerful, a coordinated campaign with the resources and expertise to ensure Mason and Samuel's complete destruction. We established our headquarters in my I, Portland apartment, creating what Valerie dubbed the Sisterhood of Betrayed Wives and Fed-Up Investigators. The dining room table expanded to accommodate 3 laptops, multiple phones, and an ever-growing collection of evidence that now filled 4 large boxes. Our first strategic meeting revealed the full scope of what we were dealing with. Valerie's 2 years of patient documentation had uncovered financial crimes totaling over $8 million. Danica's professional surveillance had mapped the entire network of conspirators and their methods. My real estate expertise had identified the technical aspects of their fraud that would be most damaging in court. "We need to coordinate our revelations," I explained, pointing to a timeline we'd constructed on the wall. "If we dump everything at once, they might find ways to compartmentalize the damage or blame everything on the federal investigation. But if we release information strategically, we control the narrative," Danica finished. "Each revelation builds on the last one, creating a cascade effect they can't manage." Valerie pulled out her phone and scrolled through a list of contacts. "I still have friends in the city planning department, people who worked with Roberto Martinez before he was killed. They want justice for him. But they've been afraid to speak up because they didn't have protection. What kind of protection do they need? Witness protection, legal immunity, guarantee that their testimony won't cost them their jobs." Valerie paused. "The corruption goes deeper than just Samuel's company. Roberto was investigating a systematic pattern of bribery and safety violations that involves people with real power in this city. That explained why the federal investigation had moved so quickly. The FBI hadn't just stumbled onto a local construction fraud. They'd uncovered a corruption network that threatened public safety on a massive scale." Danica's phone buzzed with an encrypted message. "Andy Richardson just sent an update from Sacramento. Mason's getting desperate. He withdrew $50,000 in cash yesterday, and he's been making calls to offshore banking services. Flight risk. Mason was preparing to run, which meant we needed to accelerate our timeline before he could disappear with whatever money he'd managed to steal." "There's something else," Danica continued. "Mason hired a second private investigator yesterday. Someone with a reputation for finding people who don't want to be found. He's escalating," I realized. "He knows I'm alive, and he's moving from trying to cover up my disappearance to actively hunting me." Valerie's expression turned grim. "Samuel's been asking questions about untraceable cell phones and fake identification documents. They're not just planning to run, they're planning to eliminate loose ends before they go." The room fell silent as the implications settled in. I wasn't just a missing person anymore. I was a threat that needed to be neutralized. They devolved from planning my murder for insurance money, to planning my murder for survival. "We need law enforcement protection," Danica said. "Real protection, not just surveillance. And we need to make our move before they make theirs," I added. Valerie stood up and walked to the window, looking out at the Portland skyline. "I have a contact at the U.S. Attorney's Office, someone who worked on Roberto's case before it was closed. She never believed the accident theory, but she couldn't prove murder without more evidence." "What's her name?" "Assistant U.S. Attorney Nikita Patel. She specializes in public corruption cases, and she's been watching the federal investigation with interest. If we can give her everything we have, properly documented and legally obtained, she can build a case that goes beyond financial fraud to include murder and conspiracy," Danica finished. I felt the pieces clicking into place. We weren't just seeking revenge anymore. We were seeking justice for Roberto Martinez and protection for ourselves. The federal investigation had given us the perfect cover to surface with our evidence without appearing to be the primary sources. "What? Do we need to make this work?" Valerie returned to the table and pulled out a legal pad. "First, we need to ensure all our evidence is properly documented and authenticated. Second, we need witness protection for everyone involved. Third, we need to coordinate with the federal investigation so our evidence supports, rather than compromises, their case. And fourth," Danica added, "we need to move fast. My sources say Mason's planning something for this weekend. Whatever he's planning, it's big enough that he's brought in outside help." "Outside help? Professional criminals, most likely," Mason had gone from lawyer to conspirator to someone willing to hire killers. The escalation was terrifying but also revealing. He was making choices that would leave more evidence and involve more people who could eventually testify against him. "Contact your U.S. attorney friend," I told Valerie. "Set up a meeting for tomorrow. Tell her we have evidence in 3 separate murder cases and a federal corruption investigation." 3 murder cases? Roberto Martinez, the murder they planned. For me? And whatever they're planning for this weekend. I looked at both women, feeling the weight of what we were about to unleash. We're not just taking down Mason and Samuel anymore. We're taking down everyone who helped them, everyone who looked the other way, and everyone who profited from Roberto's death. Valerie smiled grimly. Good. It's time these people learned that some women don't just disappear quietly. As we prepared for what would likely be our final meeting before surfacing with our evidence, I felt something I hadn't experienced since that night I'd overheard their murder plot. Hope. We weren't victims anymore. We were justice. The meeting with Assistant U.S. Attorney Nikita Patel took place in a secure conference room at the Federal Building in Portland. She was younger than I'd expected, maybe 35, with sharp eyes that missed nothing, and a reputation for building airtight cases against public corruption. "Before we begin," she said, reviewing the preliminary documents Valerie had provided, "I need to understand why you're coming forward now, and why you chose to disappear rather than immediately contact law enforcement." I'd prepared for this question, knowing that my decision to vanish would require explanation, because I needed to gather evidence without alerting the conspirators. If I'd gone to police immediately with just the recording of their murder plot, they could have claimed it was taken out of context, or that they were joking or planning a fictional scenario. "And now? Now we have 2 years of documented financial crimes, evidence of a prior murder, and proof of a systematic corruption network that's been operating under federal jurisdiction." I gestured to the boxes of evidence we'd brought. "Now we have a case that can't be dismissed or plea bargained away." Nikita spent the next 3 hours reviewing our evidence with the intensity of a surgeon examining x-rays. She asked pointed questions about chain of custody, legal acquisition methods, and corroborating witnesses. By the time she finished, I could see the excitement building behind her professional composure. "This is extraordinary," she said finally. "You've essentially conducted a parallel investigation that supports and extends the federal case we've been building. The Roberto Martinez evidence alone could reopen that investigation as a homicide. What do you need from us? Formal statements, witness protection arrangements, and coordination with ongoing federal operations?" She paused, studying me carefully. "But there's something else. We believe your husband and his brother are planning to flee the country this weekend. We've been monitoring their communications and financial activities." My blood chilled. "They're running? Worse. Based on intercepted communications, we think they're planning to eliminate potential witnesses before they go. That includes you, once they locate you, and possibly Valerie." Valerie leaned forward. "What kind of communications?" "Samuel made contact with someone the FBI has been tracking. A man who specializes in making people disappear permanently. The arrangement appears to be for multiple targets." The room fell silent as the implications sank in. Mason and Samuel weren't just planning to escape, they were planning to murder anyone who could testify against them. "How much time do we have?" Danica asked. "The intercepted communications suggest they're moving this weekend. Today is Thursday, which gives us less than 48 hours to coordinate a response that protects witnesses while preserving the integrity of multiple investigations." Nikita opened her laptop and began typing rapidly. "Here's what we're going to do. First, all 3 of you go into immediate protective custody. Second, we accelerate the federal case timeline and move to arrest the primary conspirators before they can flee or harm anyone. Third, we use your evidence to expand the charges to include murder conspiracy and witness intimidation." "What about the hired killer Samuel contacted?" "That's already being handled. The person Samuel thinks he hired actually works for the FBI. We've been running a sting operation targeting people who hire contract killers, and your husband and brother-in-law just walked into it." I felt a surge of satisfaction. Mason and Samuel's paranoia and desperation had led them directly into a federal trap. Their attempt to solve their problems with murder had instead provided law enforcement with ironclad evidence of conspiracy to commit murder. "There's one more thing," Nikita continued. "We'd like you to make contact with Mason under controlled circumstances with full surveillance and protection. If we can get him to admit to the murder plot or discuss the Roberto Martinez killing on tape, you want me to wear a wire?" We want you to have a conversation that gives him the opportunity to confess, threaten you, or otherwise incriminate himself. The recording you already have is powerful, but a direct admission to you would be devastating in court. The idea terrified and exhilarated me in equal measure. After weeks of hiding, gathering evidence, and planning from the shadows, I would finally confront Mason directly. But this time, I would be protected, prepared, and in control. How would it work? We arrange for Mason to discover your location through channels that won't compromise the investigation. He comes to confront you, thinking he has the advantage. Instead, he finds himself in a controlled environment where every word is recorded and federal agents are positioned to intervene if necessary. Valerie reached across the table and squeezed my hand. You don't have to do this. We have enough evidence to convict them without putting you at risk. No, I said, surprised by the firmness in my own voice. I want to look him in the eye when he realizes he's lost. I want him to understand that the woman he planned to murder is the one who destroyed him. Nikita smiled grimly. Then let's give you that opportunity. But we do this my way, with my people, under my control. Mason thinks he's been hunting you for weeks. It's time to show him who the real predator is. As we finalized the details of what would be Mason's final performance, I felt the last pieces of my transformation clicking into place. The frightened woman who had fled in the night was gone. What remained was someone who had learned to hunt. The hunters. Tomorrow, Mason would get exactly what he'd been looking for. He just wouldn't survive finding it. The setup was perfect. Through carefully orchestrated leaks, Mason learned that I'd been spotted at a coffee shop in downtown Sacramento, apparently preparing to return home. The FBI arranged for him to overhear a conversation suggesting I would be at our old house that evening, alone and vulnerable. I waited in our living room, the same room where I'd first overheard their murder plot through the baby monitor. The irony was intentional. Federal agents were positioned throughout the house and neighborhood, invisible but ready. Agent Rodriguez spoke quietly in my earpiece, confirming that all recording equipment was active and backup units were in position. Remember, Rodriguez's voice was calm in my ear. Let him talk. Give him opportunities to incriminate himself. We need him to admit to the conspiracy on tape. The house felt different now. No longer the sanctuary I'd once believed it to be, but a stage where the final act of Mason's destruction would play out. I'd positioned myself in the chair where I used to read, where I'd planned surprise dinners for him, where I'd dreamed of the children we'd never have. Now it would be where he learned that his perfect victim had become his perfect nemesis. At 8:47 p.m., I heard his key in the lock. My heart hammered against my ribs, but my voice was steady as I called out. "Hello, Mason?" He appeared in the doorway, and for a moment neither of us spoke. He looked terrible. Hollow-eyed, unshaven, 20 pounds thinner than when I'd disappeared. The stress of managing his conspiracy while pretending to be a grieving husband had taken its toll. His expensive suit hung loose on his frame, and his hands trembled slightly as he gripped the doorframe. "Jessica." His voice cracked on my name, and I saw him struggle to process what he was seeing. "Where have you been?" "I've been going crazy. Thinking you were..." "We've been searching everywhere." The performance was flawless. The concerned husband, overwhelmed with relief at finding his missing wife. If I hadn't known the truth, I might have believed it myself. But I could see the calculation behind his eyes. The rapid assessment of this unexpected situation. "I know exactly where you've been searching," I said calmly. My voice carrying none of the warmth it once held for him, and I know why. His face went pale, the mask of relief slipping slightly. "What do you mean?" "I mean, I heard everything, Mason. That Tuesday night when you thought I was at yoga. I heard you and Samuel planning my accident. I heard you discussing my insurance policy and how to make my murder look convincing." The transformation was subtle, but unmistakable. The desperate husband persona flickered and died, replaced by something colder, more calculating. I watched him mentally shift gears, moving from relief to damage control. "You don't understand," he said finally, stepping fully into the room but maintaining distance. "It wasn't supposed to be like this. The business problems, the debts, we were desperate. Desperate enough to murder me?" I kept my voice level, professional, as if we were discussing a business transaction rather than my planned death, desperate enough to consider options. His voice hardened, and I saw the mask of the devoted husband finally slip away completely. "Do you have any idea how much debt we're carrying? How close we are to losing everything?" "We?" I stood up slowly, letting the word hang between us. "You mean how close you are to losing everything you stole from me?" His laugh was bitter, devoid of any warmth I'd once found attractive. I built this life. I made the connections that got you your first big contracts. I provided the legal framework that made your business possible. His voice rose, desperation, bleeding through the anger. You owe me everything. And when I needed help, you were too busy playing successful businesswoman to notice your own husband drowning. So you decided to drown me instead. You disappeared on your own, he snapped, beginning to pace like a caged animal. Maybe that's for the best. Maybe we can still work this out. Come back. Help me fix the business problems, and we can forget any of this happened. The audacity was breathtaking. Even now, faced with the evidence of his conspiracy, he was trying to manipulate me, to convince me that my attempted murder was somehow a reasonable business solution. Like you forgot about Roberto Martinez, the race? Name hit him like a physical blow, his face went white, and I saw the moment he realized exactly how much I knew. His pacing stopped abruptly, and his eyes darted toward the windows, calculating escape routes. How do you? He couldn't finish the question, couldn't bring himself to ask how I'd discovered their earlier murder. I know about all of it, Mason. The corruption, the fraud, the murder, and now everyone else knows too. The room fell silent except for the sound of his ragged breathing. I could see him processing the implications, understanding that this wasn't a reconciliation or even a confrontation. It was a trap that had been months in the making. You've been alive this whole time, he said slowly, the pieces clicking into place. You've been watching us, gathering evidence, learning from the best, I replied. You taught me everything I needed to know about patience, planning, and playing. The long game. As if summoned by my words, FBI agents stepped into the room from multiple entrances. Mason spun around, seeing his escape routes blocked, understanding finally that he'd walked into a carefully orchestrated takedown. Mason Williams, Agent Rodriguez announced, stepping forward with handcuffs ready. You're under arrest for conspiracy to commit murder, wire fraud, and racketeering. The look on Mason's face as the handcuffs clicked into place was everything I'd hoped for. Shock, rage, and the dawning realization that he'd been outmaneuvered by the woman he'd planned to kill. The hunter had become the hunted, and the hunt was finally over. The arrests happened simultaneously across Sacramento, in a coordinated operation that the FBI had been planning for weeks. While Mason was being read his rights in our living room, federal agents were taking Samuel into custody at his construction office, finding him in the middle of shredding documents. Victor Castellanos was arrested at his home during a family dinner, his wife and children watching in shock as their father was led away in handcuffs. The coordination was flawless. No one had time to warn the others, destroy evidence, or flee. Within 2 hours, 17 people connected to the corruption network were in federal custody, from low-level inspectors who'd falsified safety reports to city council members who'd fast-tracked fraudulent contracts. I spent that first night in a safe house watching the news coverage, with a mixture of satisfaction and surreal disbelief. Federal corruption ring uncovered, the headlines read. Missing woman's reappearance exposes murder plot. My face was on every news channel. But now, as a survivor and witness rather than a victim, Agent Rodriguez joined me for the debriefing. His satisfaction evident as he reviewed the night's arrests. Samuel broke immediately, he reported. Started confessing before we even finished reading him his rights. He's so terrified of the murder conspiracy charges that he's trying to trade information for any kind of deal. What kind of information? Everything. Bank records, bribery schedules, safety violations, even the location where they disposed of evidence from Roberto Martinez's car. Rodriguez paused. He also confirmed details about the hired killer arrangement. Apparently, Mason was planning to eliminate both you and Valerie this weekend. The scope of their desperation was staggering. They'd been so close to complete exposure that they'd planned to commit multiple murders rather than face the consequences of their crimes. What about Mason? Maintaining his innocence and demanding a lawyer, he's trying to claim that Samuel manipulated him, that he had no knowledge of any murder plots. Rodriguez shook his head. It won't work. We have him on tape planning your death, and Samuel's confession fills in every detail. The evidence we'd compiled over weeks of careful planning overwhelmed the justice system in the best possible way. Federal prosecutors found themselves with so much documented proof that plea bargaining became impossible. The conspiracy was too extensive, the crimes too serious, and the evidence too comprehensive for any deals beyond cooperation in exchange for life sentences instead of death penalties. Within hours, the investigation exploded across local and national news. The corruption scheme had tentacles reaching into city government, state contracting agencies, and federal highway projects. The estimated fraud totaled over $50 million with safety violations that had put thousands of lives at risk. I watched the first press conference from the safe house feeling surreal as Assistant U.S. Attorney Nikita Patel detailed the charges. This investigation has uncovered a systematic pattern of corruption, fraud, and violence that threaten public safety across multiple jurisdictions. We have evidence of fraudulent contracts worth over $50 million, safety violations that endangered citizens, and a conspiracy that included the murder of a city inspector and the planned murders of multiple witnesses. Roberto Martinez's widow appeared at the press conference, flanked by her attorneys and representatives from the newly formed Families Rights Organization. She'd filed a wrongful death lawsuit against everyone involved in the conspiracy, armed with the evidence Valerie and I had provided. "My husband died because he was trying to protect people," Maria said through tears, her voice growing stronger as she continued. "These men killed him to protect their profits. They turned our city's construction industry into a criminal enterprise that put children at risk every day. Today, we finally have justice for Roberto, and protection for future whistleblowers." The domino effect continued throughout the week, as the investigation's scope became clear. Three school districts announced immediate safety inspections of all buildings constructed or renovated by Samuel's company. The mayor called for a complete audit of all city contracts awarded in the past 5 years. The governor announced AEI, statewide task force to investigate construction fraud. Five additional construction companies were shut down pending investigation when their connections to the corruption network became apparent. Two banks faced federal scrutiny for their role in laundering proceeds from fraudulent contracts. A dozen city employees were suspended pending the outcome of criminal charges, but the most satisfying moment came when I learned about Samuel's complete psychological breakdown during his interrogation. Faced with overwhelming evidence and the knowledge that his hired killer was actually an FBI agent, he'd confessed to everything. The corruption scheme, the Roberto Martinez murder, and the detailed plans to kill me and Valerie. He gave us a complete timeline, Agent Rodriguez reported during one of our debriefing sessions. Dates, methods, financial transactions, even recordings of conversations with Mason about the best ways to stage your accident. He's trying to trade information for a reduced sentence, but with the charges he's facing, cooperation might get him life without parole instead of the death penalty. Mason, predictably, maintained his innocence and blamed everything on Samuel's manipulation and the federal investigation's pressure. His lawyers were pushing for a mental health defense, claiming the stress of my disappearance had caused a psychological break that made him susceptible to Samuel's influence. The strategy was doomed to fail. The evidence showed months of careful planning that preceded my disappearance, including the life insurance increase, the recruitment of corrupt officials, and the systematic embezzlement from my business accounts. No temporary insanity defense could explain such methodical preparation. Valerie found particular satisfaction in watching Samuel's construction empire collapse completely. "Every building he worked on is being inspected," she told me during one of our daily calls. 3. Schools have been evacuated pending safety reviews. The city is facing hundreds of millions in liability because they trusted his fraudulent certifications. The investigation had taken on its own momentum, growing beyond anything Mason and Samuel could have anticipated when they'd first planned my murder. Their attempt to solve their problems with violence had instead created a federal case that would reshape Sacramento's entire construction industry and serve as a model for corruption investigations nationwide. The weeks following the arrest brought a systematic dismantling of everything Mason and Samuel had built on lies and violence, but my victory wasn't passive. I actively orchestrated each revelation to maximize damage and ensure no aspect of their corruption escaped consequences. Working with Gerald, my attorney, I filed a comprehensive civil lawsuit that went beyond simple recovery of stolen funds. Using my real estate expertise, I identified every property, contract, and business relationship they'd corrupted using my credentials. The lawsuit sought damages not just for the money they'd stolen, but for the systematic destruction of my professional reputation, the emotional trauma of discovering my husband's murder plot, and the ongoing security costs required to protect myself from future retaliation. "The civil case is almost more devastating than the criminal charges," Gerald explained during one of our strategy sessions, surrounded by boxes of evidence that now filled his entire conference room. "We're seeking treble damages under RICO statutes, punitive damages for the attempted murder, and comprehensive restitution for every fraudulent contract that used your credentials. Even if they somehow avoided prison, they'd spend the rest of their lives in financial servitude. But prison was inevitable." Samuel's confession had created a cascade of plea deals as other conspirators rushed to cooperate before the best deals were taken. The mechanic who'd sabotaged Roberto Martinez's brakes testified in exchange for reduced charges, providing technical details about how they'd made the murder look like mechanical failure. Victor Castellanos provided detailed records of every bribe and fraudulent contract approval, complete with dates, amounts, and recordings he'd secretly made as insurance against his CO conspirators. Even some of Mason's law firm partners came forward with evidence of suspicious activities they'd previously ignored, hoping to avoid charges for willful blindness to their colleagues' criminal behavior. The professional consequences were swift and merciless. Mason was disbarred within a month, his law license permanently revoked by the State Bar Association. The disbarment proceedings included public hearings where the full scope of his corruption was detailed, ensuring that his professional destruction was as visible as his criminal prosecution. Samuel's construction license was canceled, and his company was banned from all future government contracts. The State Licensing Board also revoked the certifications of every inspector and engineer who'd worked with him, creating a ripple effect that destroyed dozens of careers built on corruption. The broader professional impact was even more satisfying. Contractors, suppliers, and subcontractors who'd worked with Samuel found themselves under investigation or blacklisted by association. Three major suppliers lost city contracts worth millions when their connections to the corruption network became public. Two engineering firms faced federal investigation for their role in approving falsified safety reports. I took particular satisfaction in the financial destruction. Through the FBI's asset forfeiture process, every account, property, and investment they'd acquired through illegal means was seized. The house Mason and I had shared, appraised at $2,300,000, became federal property. Samuel's construction equipment, worth over $800,000, was auctioned to compensate victims. Even their personal vehicles were seized when prosecutors proved they'd been purchased with stolen funds, but the systematic nature of their financial ruin went deeper. Their credit was destroyed, their bank accounts frozen, their insurance policies canceled. Mason's law firm partnership was dissolved, and his share of the firm's assets was seized to pay restitution. Samuel's ex-wife, Valerie, successfully argued that his hidden assets should be considered marital property subject to division, essentially ensuring that even money he'd hidden from his first criminal conspiracy would be recovered. The psychological pressure proved even more effective than legal consequences. Danica's contacts in the prison system reported that both men were struggling with the reality of their situation. Mason, who'd built his identity around being the smartest person in the room, couldn't accept that he'd been outmaneuvered by the wife he'd planned to murder. "He's been writing letters," Agent Rodriguez reported during one of our regular updates, "to judges, prosecutors, journalists, anyone who will listen. He's trying to claim that you orchestrated this entire situation, that you somehow manipulated Samuel into the murder plot to frame him." The accusations were absurd and easily disproven by the timeline of evidence, but they revealed Mason's complete inability to accept responsibility for his actions. Even facing life in prison, he was still trying to manipulate the narrative. Samuel had suffered what his lawyers termed a complete psychological break. Faced with evidence of his crimes and the knowledge that his attempt to hire a killer had been a federal sting operation, he'd stopped eating and was under psychiatric observation. His mental health deterioration was so severe that prosecutors had to delay some depositions until he could be stabilized enough to participate in his own defense. "They're both trying to blame each other now," Agent Rodriguez explained. "Mason claims Samuel manipulated him into the murder plot through threats and emotional pressure. Samuel insists Mason was the mastermind who convinced him to escalate from fraud to violence." Neither story holds up against the evidence, but it shows how completely their partnership has collapsed. The media coverage continued to favor the narrative I'd carefully constructed. I gave selective interviews, always emphasizing my role as a survivor, rather than an active participant in their downfall. The public saw me as a woman who'd escaped a murder plot through intelligence and courage, not someone who'd systematically destroyed her would-be killers. But perhaps the most satisfying element was watching their support networks collapse. Friends who'd once defended them publicly began distancing themselves as evidence mounted. Extended family members changed their names to avoid association. Professional colleagues deleted social media connections and refused to provide character references. Mason's brother, who lived in Denver, publicly denounced him and changed his phone number to avoid media calls. Samuel's elderly parents issued a statement expressing their horror at their son's crimes and their support for his victims. Even their former law school and business school classmates organized to remove their names from alumni publications. They built their conspiracy on the assumption that they could control the narrative and eliminate witnesses. Instead, they created a story that would follow them for the rest of their lives. A story where they were the villains and I was the survivor who brought them to justice. The trial began 18 months after my disappearance in a federal courthouse, packed with media, victims' families, and federal agents who'd worked the case. I sat in the front row of the gallery, no longer hiding, no longer afraid. Mason and Samuel, dressed in orange jumpsuits and shackled at their ankles, couldn't meet my eyes. The prosecution's opening statement was devastating. U.S. Attorney Nikita Patel methodically outlined the conspiracy using our carefully gathered evidence to paint a picture of systematic corruption that had culminated in murder. She played the recording of Mason and Samuel planning my death. Their casual discussion of insurance payouts and accident scenarios echoing through the silent courtroom. The defendants didn't just plan to steal money, Patel told the jury. They planned to steal a life. Jessica Williams wasn't just their victim. She was their cash cow, their credibility shield, and ultimately their intended murder victim. They turned trust into a weapon and love into a trap. The evidence presentation took 3 weeks. Bank records showing systematic theft. Safety inspection documents proving their willful endangerment of public safety. Phone records documenting their coordination with corrupt city officials. And finally, the recording of their murder plot played multiple times, as prosecutors highlighted specific phrases that proved premeditation. Samuel's defense attorney attempted to portray him as a desperate man, manipulated by his more sophisticated brother-in-law. The strategy collapsed when prosecutors presented evidence of Samuel's independent criminal activities, including bribes he'd paid before ever involving Mason. Mason's defense was even more pathetic. His lawyers claimed he'd been driven to temporary insanity by financial stress and my disappearance. The argument crumbled when prosecutors demonstrated the months of careful planning that had preceded my vanishing, including the life insurance increase and the recruitment of corrupt officials. The most powerful moment came when I took the stand. I'd prepared for this testimony for months, working with prosecutors to ensure every word carried maximum impact. When did you first realize your husband was planning to kill you? Patel asked. The moment I heard him discussing my insurance policy. Through our baby monitor, I replied, my voice steady and clear. He was talking about my death like a business transaction. My murder was just another item on his agenda. What went through your mind in that moment? That the man I'd loved and trusted for 8 years had never existed. That I'd been married to a stranger who saw me as a resource to be exploited and ultimately eliminated. Mason's cross-examination was brief and ineffective. His attorney couldn't challenge my testimony without highlighting the evidence of his client's guilt. Every question they asked gave me another opportunity to detail their conspiracy. The jury deliberated for less than 6 hours. When they returned, the forewoman's voice was firm and clear. Guilty on all counts. Mason showed no emotion as the EI verdicts were read. Samuel broke down completely, sobbing as he realized his life was effectively over. The families of their victims, Roberto Martinez's widow, the residents of buildings with compromised safety features, the taxpayers who'd funded their fraudulent contracts finally had their justice. During the sentencing phase, I delivered my victim impact statement. I looked directly at Mason as I spoke, ensuring he understood the full scope of his failure. You taught me that some people view love as weakness and trust as opportunity, I said. But you also taught me that survivors can be more dangerous than victims, and that justice is always worth the wait. Judge Morrison sentenced Mason to life without parole plus 20 years. Samuel received life with the possibility of parole after 30 years. Both men would die in federal prison. The sentencing brought closure, but the true resolution came in the months that followed as I rebuilt not just my life, but my understanding of who I'd become through this ordeal. The woman who walked out of that courthouse was fundamentally different from the one who'd fled in terror 18 months earlier. The financial recovery exceeded even Gerald's optimistic projections. The civil lawsuit resulted in a $12 million judgment, though collecting from two men serving life sentences proved largely symbolic. More significant was the recovery of assets through the federal forfeiture process, and the insurance settlement that paid out after the criminal convictions made Mason's murder plot undeniable. I used the money to establish the Roberto Martinez Foundation, dedicated to construction safety advocacy and supporting families of workers killed by corporate negligence. Roberto's widow, Maria, became the foundation's first director, channeling her grief into ensuring no other family would suffer as hers had. The professional vindication was equally important. Every construction project that had been compromised by Samuel's fraud was rebuilt to proper safety standards funded by the city's settlement payments. My business license was not only restored, but came with a formal acknowledgement from the state licensing board that I'd been the victim of identity fraud rather than a willing participant in corruption. Valerie and I maintained our alliance, though it evolved from conspiracy to genuine friendship. She'd used her portion of the recovered assets to start a consulting firm that helped municipalities identify and prevent construction fraud. Turns out being married to a criminal gives you unique insights into how they operate, she told me, with dark humor. Danica had parlayed her role in the investigation into a position with the FBI's white-collar crime division. Her expertise in uncovering financial conspiracies made her invaluable to federal investigators, and she'd already broken two more corruption cases using techniques we'd developed together. The media attention gradually faded, but not before the MBS case became a textbook example taught in law schools and business ethics courses. Students studied how a trusted relationship could be weaponized for fraud and murder, and how one person's refusal to be a victim could bring down an entire criminal network. The psychological healing took longer. I underwent extensive therapy to process not just the trauma of discovering the murder plot, but the deeper betrayal of realizing my entire marriage had been a manipulation. Dr. Sarah Chen, no relation despite the surname, specialized in helping survivors of intimate partner violence understand that they weren't responsible for their abuser's choices. You didn't create Mason's criminality by being successful or generous, she reminded me during one session. His decision to see you as a target rather than a partner reveals his character, not yours. The most profound change was in how I approached relationships. I'd learned to trust my instincts, to verify rather than assume, and to maintain independence even within intimate partnerships. The skills I'd developed during my disappearance, surveillance, evidence gathering, strategic thinking, became permanent parts of my personality. 6 months after the sentencing, I received an unexpected letter from Mason in prison. He'd written to apologize, to claim he'd found religion, and realized the magnitude of his crimes. I read it once, then burned it. Some apologies come too late and cost too much to mean anything. The final resolution came not through forgiveness, but through understanding that I'd not only survived their conspiracy, I'd transformed it into something that made the world safer for others. Justice, it turned out, was the best revenge of all. 3 years after that night when I heard my own murder being planned, I stood in the conference room of my new company, looking out at Sacramento's skyline. The view was different from this building, cleaner somehow, as if the corruption that had once tainted the city's construction industry had been literally washed away. My new firm, Phoenix Development Solutions, had become one of California's most respected real estate companies, built on a foundation of absolute transparency and ethical practices that I'd learned were more than just good business. They were survival skills. Every contract included anti-corruption clauses, every project underwent independent safety inspections, and every client received detailed documentation of our compliance procedures. The irony wasn't lost on me that Mason and Samuel's attempt to destroy my reputation had ultimately enhanced it. Clients sought me out specifically because I was the developer who'd exposed the corruption ring, who'd prioritize public safety over profit margins. My survival story had become a brand of integrity that competitors couldn't replicate. Andy Richardson had become my head of security, officially retired from private investigation, but still maintaining the vigilance that had helped save my life. Old habits, he'd say, when I caught him running background checks on new employees or installing additional security systems in my office. The Roberto Martinez Foundation had grown beyond anything I'd initially envisioned. Maria Martinez had proven to be a formidable advocate, using her husband's memory to drive legislative changes in construction oversight. 3 states had passed Roberto's laws requiring independent safety inspections and whistleblower protections for workers who reported violations. But the most profound changes were personal. I'd remarried 8 months ago to Dr. James Chen, Sarah's brother, and a federal prosecutor who'd worked on white-collar crime cases. The relationship had developed slowly, built on complete honesty about my past and his understanding of the psychological complexity of surviving intimate betrayal. "You know I'm going to run background checks on you periodically," I'd told him before our first official date. "Good," he'd replied. "I'd be worried if you didn't." Our wedding had been small, attended by the core group of people who'd helped me survive and rebuild. Valerie, Danica, Andy, Gerald, and the Rodriguez family from the FBI. The ceremony included a memorial moment for Roberto Martinez, acknowledging that our celebration was possible because others had paid the ultimate price for exposing the truth. The nightmares had mostly stopped, replaced by dreams of construction projects that actually protected people and business deals that created value rather than extracting it. But I still kept emergency bags packed in 3 different locations, still maintained bank accounts that only I knew about, still had Danica run periodic checks to ensure Mason and Samuel remained in federal custody. Some lessons, once learned, become permanent parts of your operating system. Last week, I received a letter from a woman in Phoenix whose husband had been embezzling from her business while planning to leave her for his secretary. She'd read about my case and wanted advice on protecting herself while gathering evidence. I called her that same day because the most important thing I'd learned wasn't just how to survive betrayal. It was how to use that survival to help others. Mason had tried to make me a victim, but instead he'd created something much more dangerous. A woman who understood exactly how predators operated and was willing to teach others to recognize the signs. The woman who disappeared in fear had been replaced by someone who made fear disappear for others. Jessica Williams was dead, but what had risen from her ashes was something Mason could never have anticipated. A protector who'd learned from the masters of manipulation and chose to use those skills to expose rather than exploit. Sometimes the best revenge isn't just surviving. It's thriving in ways your enemies never thought possible. Up next, thanks for watching, take care, good luck.
Asterisk after listening to today's story, perhaps it has raised some new questions in your mind, or maybe it has brought back some old memories. Every day on Reddit, new experiences and moments create fresh stories, and they connect all of us. Everyone has their own unique journey in life, and we all try to understand the world in our own way. These kinds of moments remind us that we are all human, sometimes happy, sometimes sad, and always learning something new. If you enjoyed this story, feel free to share it with your friends. Your thoughts and feedback are always valuable to us, as they motivate us to create even better content. Every story has its own unique angle, and our goal is to understand everyone's perspective and make our content diverse and relatable. Stories like these help us realize that life's journey is different for everyone, and by hearing other stories, we learn something new. You can also share your own stories with us. Your experiences are valuable to us as well, and if you enjoyed this video, please leave your feedback. We aim to create content that brightens your mind and gives you new ideas every time. If you've already seen this video before, your feedback is still important. With every piece of feedback, we can improve our content and bring a new perspective to our viewers. Today, what we saw was just a small part of the many stories shared on Reddit and across the world. It's a reminder of how we all try to understand life by sharing our experiences with each other. This video was only an example of how we try to connect with others through storytelling, learning about different sides of life. We hope to continue sharing such stories that help us all learn and grow together. Thank you for your time, and don't forget to keep an eye out for more stories coming soon. If you haven't already, please like and follow for more amazing content. Your support keeps us going, and we will strive to bring you more thought-provoking and heartwarming stories. Until next time, take care and stay curious. Asterisk.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Hey, everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.